This podcast is part of the Cannabis Media Collective. To enjoy all of the podcasts within the collective, just go to your favorite streaming app or site and subscribe to the Cannabis Media Collective. For more info, check out distinctmedia.ca.
The Periodic Effects Cannabis Business and Science Podcast is brought to you by Periodic Edibles, the cannabis caramel company, available in Oregon.
I think that anytime there's a rush to something that's financially exciting and viable, it's always going to be pioneered by smaller businesses because they're the ones willing to take the risk.
You, in fact, had a comment you wanted to make, Richard.
Well, it's rather moved on. I was just going to say I can't imagine why anyone should think it was an ethical problem. I can see why they might think it was a...
Hello and welcome back to the Periodic Effects Cannabis Business and Science Podcast. My name is Wayne and I'll be your host. We upload new episodes every Monday night, bringing you an insider look at cannabis business operators and the latest updates and studies on cannabis science research. All right, this is a business-focused episode we recorded on November 13th, 2019. And we've got two guests today, Jody and Carrie, co-founders of Leaf Goods and Greater Goods, an edible company in Oregon, also with a hemp CBD line. And in this conversation, we talk about their experience starting Leaf Goods about 6 years ago, going through an incubator accelerator program, raising money, starting a hemp CBD line, a retail storefront, e-commerce for the CBD line. A lot of good information and great experience and perspective from someone, a couple who's been in it for a while. They're also a husband and wife, which is we talk about as well, starting this business together. Really enjoyed this conversation. I think there's a lot of insights in here about what can be expected if you're in the cannabis industry and also planning for the future. What's the future of this market going to look like? Easter egg at the end, they are hiring, so look for that at the end of the episode. We discuss it there. And one note before we jump into it, I forgot to hit record on the beginning of this episode, so it's going to pick up with Jody talking right after I think he says they started the business about 6 years ago. So sorry, Carrie and Jody. I've only done that a couple of times, forgetting to hit record, but I caught it quick, so we got the whole episode. Let's get into it. Here's Carrie and Jody, co-founders of Leaf Goods and Greater Goods.
And then in 2013, I believe, they changed some rules. And so a lot of the products that I liked disappeared. And what was out there as a topical wasn't really something that we liked. So we decided, just to make our own. We're pretty crafty in the kitchen. So one day I started playing around with doing our own extraction. And then we started doing our own topicals. And they worked really well. They smelled nice and they had a really good texture. And we decided, why don't we try to sell these? So Carrie is a branding design person and she sunk together some packaging for it. And we literally drove around town to dispensaries trying to sell our topicals.
And it worked.
And it worked.
Yeah, those early days were so interesting, and some states now just going through that, like California is right now. Medical, a little more unregulated, and that shift to recreational is kind of a hard jump, especially depending on what state you're in. But yeah, you see a lot of brands just, don't make it over, or they're not on the shelf anymore. What do you attribute that to? Some of the reasons you think that during that transition, a lot of those products you saw previously were no longer on the shelf. What do you think some of the reasons are for that?
I think everybody's story is super different, right? Mm-hmm. So what worked out great for us is that in that transitional period at the end of 2016, it was called Early Start. I'm sure you remember.
Yeah.
And we were able to put out low potency edibles, and we took advantage of that 6 month period of time, which enabled us to bootstrap our way into recreational. If it hadn't been for that period of time, we would have had to either raise money or start much slower. So I think that without capital, people found it very difficult to secure a regulated kitchen space, build it out, get the licenses, go through all the security regulations. So And some people just didn't want, I think, to play that game. I think a lot of people came from black market and ended up in medical and maybe just didn't really want to go through the process of being part of the mainstream. So, you know, I feel like a lot of the people that we came into the industry with 6 years ago did make it through that transition. The harder part is staying around after that transition. Yeah, I mean, it always takes money when it comes to having physical space and licenses, even though we're the lowest and easiest point of entry, I think, of any state in the nation. Mainly is like it's a money thing and partially a desire thing. People just maybe don't want to play that game.
Yeah, it's such a different game too, or different skill set you have to figure out. And that's a really good point. Oregon being a easier entry point, so that transition being more acceptable to small businesses, or not acceptable, but achievable. But now, because of the lower entry point, you know, I think Oregon is the most saturated state in the country, I think on at least a retailer per capita basis I saw. So now that's kind of the transition was a little easier here, but now we're dealing with the surviving with so many brands and companies and still coming on to this day. It's been a really big challenge.
Yeah, I mean, this is a perfect example of free market of what, and everyone was really excited about it at first, but now the thinning of the herd is kind of necessary for the overall survival of the smaller businesses in some level, because we're seeing so many corporate entities come in who can either wait it out or buy places up. So, you know, it's great that everybody could get in, but yeah. It's coming back to bite us a little bit.
Yeah, I struggle with that so much because I love small businesses. I want the, you know, there's got to be regulations and consumer safety requirements, but I love that so many people could try to do it. But it's struggling because then now we're in this situation. Do either of you have any thoughts on maybe how it could have been done better so this could have prevented, or is this just a natural part when we take that free market approach? Like, it's going to happen and it's just something we're going to have to deal with.
Yeah, that's a really complicated question. I think that historically in the history of Oregon, part of it was that at a certain point outside state money was permitted. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think at that point when they opened that up, it really enabled larger businesses with more money to start to operate. So that perhaps could have helped our smaller industry maintain some more successes over time. I don't know. I mean, that's a good question for an economist, right? So, and you have to look at it in the long term. So I think right now a lot of the smaller businesses struggle unless they raise money or can join forces with others, whether they're other small people to consolidate or a big person. But I think in the long run, just like craft beer, it became corporatized and then it swung back in the other direction. So I think because we're in it right now, maybe we can't see the long-term advantage of it having started this way. But for those of us who can hang on, we will have the legacy of better quality products, people who've been in the industry for a really long time and really understand the plight of cannabis businesses, who have a higher sensitivity to all of the fallout from the war on drugs. So a lot of us will probably fall out, but I think by and large, in the years to come, it will be beneficial that many of us were able to get in. Just the law of averages, many of us will stick around. So I think it's important to look past like the immediate moment and see the impact of what Oregon enabled a lot of people to do. You know, in Washington, there's no vertical integration. So that's sort of an interesting problem. And some of the rules in Colorado were kind of weird too, because you needed to, you know, have a grow attached to your dispensary, which presented all sorts of other issues and maybe sort of kept more people from flooding locations. But now we're seeing the challenges of those. So I think no matter what you do, there's going to be challenges. I think, the best thing that anybody can do is what some people are trying to attempt to do in certain states, which is equity programs that promote minority-owned businesses to be in the industry and not necessarily subsidize, but really support very heavily those businesses. So perhaps that could have been something that Oregon could have established early on to be able to support some of these sort of veteran cannabis professionals. But, you know, it's hard to go back and say, like, what would have been better? Because perhaps none of us would have been able to get in at that time if there had been more restriction or a higher bar. So I'd rather be struggling now with this level of saturation than to not be in it at all.
Yeah, those are good points. It's so hard. I mean, it evolves so quickly and changes, but what's it look like in 3 years or 5 years is really hard to predict, but that's a good point. You know, at the moment, it feels like, oh, we should have done something different, but maybe that was kind of the best approach we could have taken or the state could have taken. You made a comment about craft beer being corporatized and then kind of swinging back the other way. Can you kind of elaborate on that more? Like what that, I'm not as familiar with that part of the industry and how that happened. And like, is that something that could correlate over to cannabis potentially as we go forward?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of things take that pendulum swing. You know, after alcohol prohibition, people who were still creating and distributing alcohol during that period of time were kind of like we were before legalization. And then big businesses obviously came in, the Anheuser-Busch's and the what have yous came in and saw, wow, what an opportunity. And then there's a backlash. I think there's always a backlash to commodification and corporate culture in every single sector. I mean, cannabis itself is a backlash to pharmaceutical industry infiltration. So I think you'll see micro backlashes and huge backlashes and changes in culture. So I think that anytime there's a rush to something that's financially exciting and viable, it's always going to be pioneered by smaller businesses because they're the ones willing to take the risk when bigger corporations have shareholders to answer to. So I think it's a natural progression in capitalism that's happened.
It makes sense you guys starting out as a team. Jody, operationally, Carrie, yourself doing kind of brand and marketing. Do you both still really fill those roles as a team for Leaf Goods and Greater Goods?
Yeah, we've definitely learned over the years how to separate the responsibilities out of necessity just to stay married.
Okay, that was going to kind of be my next question. I mean, there's so many advantages to, I mean, obviously you know and trust each other so much, but at the same time, that can be really risky as, you know, I was going to ask, like, how's that experience been? That's really interesting.
I mean, I wouldn't recommend it for a lot of people. But, you know, we're not traditional. Like, Jody has never really had a traditional 9-to-5 job. He's a photographer and an artist by trade and, you know, has had gigs, and projects. And I was always unhappy in corporate. And I think because we were both aligned on that level, we ended up getting into this a little bit just because we could. And then it just kind of happened. I think creative people kind of think differently than non-creative people. And on the one hand, it can be very difficult because we're strong-willed.
And we're around each other 24 hours a day.
Yeah. And we're emotional people, but we're also very logical people and sort of have a common goal. So it really depends. I've had other people ask that question. And, you know, the hardest thing to do is to turn the business conversation off. And sometimes you can't afford to turn it off. You just plow through. With the launch of Greater Goods, it's the rules of trying to separate work from life have kind of gone out the window because it's just been constant. You know, I feel like it is true. Like, I know Jody so well and vice versa that it's like being in business with yourself in many ways. I can anticipate it's going to annoy him and try not to do that. I anticipate, I know how to talk to him. It's just, And I think other business partners who are in it together who are not married get to that point. It's just the turning off the work.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's so hard with a partner to really be on the same level and communicate well. Yeah. So starting out, you mentioned bootstrapping the company, that transition into the rec market was really helpful to do that. And then something I wanted to get into that's really, you know, accelerator programs aren't new, but they are really new to cannabis. And that's something that you both went through, I don't know if it was last year or the year before. Kind of talk to us about leading up to that and why you decided to go through that process. I think most accelerators seem like it's kind of startup companies or from scratch or just barely getting going. You guys already had some traction. What made you decide to go through that accelerator and talk a little bit about the experience and just what that was like?
Yeah. So believe it or not, that started in January of this year. I think
it probably feels like forever ago, but
it really does. Not that long. Like that had to have been 2 years ago. But, you know, I had known Amy Margolis for years just being in the industry. And when I found out that she was doing this program, I think the both of us knew that it was a great opportunity because it was exactly at the same time that we knew we wanted to raise money and we don't know a lot of wealthy people. And it seemed like a no-brainer to enter into that program. We wouldn't have gone out of state for a different program. And so it was just perfect. And, you know, the experience of it, it was great. I mean, obviously, like, I think we're one of the success stories to come out of the program. The structure of the program enabled us to connect with investors and raise money, which has enabled us to kind of change our world from within. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're the first cohort. Jody was one of the only men who occasionally sat in, so he can speak to that experience.
That was a great experience. The first day was a little weird. The first week of the program, Carrie got really, really sick. Yeah. So I sat in and tried to take the best notes I could. But it was totally fine being the only guy there.
Yeah. And I think, you know, he was able to make these great connections with a couple of advisors who we still see and consult with and just enjoy hanging out with to this day. So I think they actually like him better secretly.
I bribed my way in. I brought chocolate every day.
Nice.
So, you know, I literally would show up with a bag full of goodies, and it's the best way to make friends.
Yeah, it's true. And he didn't stop the entire time.
No, every time I showed up, I brought more candy.
Everyone was relatively medicated. So.
What was one of the things you learned that, you know, just you wouldn't have got exposed to or learned without going through the accelerator that really surprised you or just really, you know, rounded out you both as a partner or as a company from going through that accelerator?
Hmm. That's a good question.
There was some corporate structure stuff that I had no clue about. And there was some legal aspects as well. But I'm not really that type of person in the company. I'm more operational. Like, I like to make everything. Mm-hmm. So that was really kind of new to me. And I never would have realized any of that.
I think, like, we got all types of, like, little bits of granular information. Like, there was a plethora of days around legal and little things to think about. And I think the biggest learning experience has now come after the program. Mm-hmm. Really learning and growing and trying to expand into the hemp world is much more difficult than we anticipated. There's not a lot of transition from our THC consumers into the CBD consumer because we make high CBD products in the THC side anyway. So a lot of them are very happy to stay with our products over there. So, and, you know, negotiating, how to interact with investors and just rapid expansion has been such a learning experience. And obviously it's connected to the initiative. So I think really the surprises have come in the months since the program, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard as I think small businesses and especially people like yourselves and start early in the industry, you know, we really like to make things, branding, marketing, and kind of that raising money side, corporate finance structure is like really unknown and intimidating. And it's always one of those things that you can kind of leave off, never really pay attention to. And then one day, this one wrong paperwork like shuts down the company or something really bad. So those pieces are critical. And it always, to me, seems like a black box. Like there's so much you don't know that you don't know. So that seems like it'd be a huge value add around that.
Yeah, I think like one of the biggest lessons is that lawyers are essential and expensive.
Expensive. Yeah.
But like you get what you pay for. So like we love our lawyers. They're good lawyers. They're responsive and supportive. And I feel like they're part of our, you know, village that it takes to raise this new baby kind of. And that is interesting because like it's true. You come in as a bootstrapper entrepreneur and lawyers are the last thing that you think that you're gonna have as a crucial part of your team, but then it starts to happen and you get people writing to you about IP things and you know you're trying to manage trademarking and yeah, the corporate structure thing was interesting and investors don't want to be plant touching, so that is a really big challenge for companies like ours to structure it properly. So it's kind of the boring stuff, but it's exciting to now know it.
Yeah. Around the raising money piece, what, you know, presenting to investors, what kind of things are they looking for? Or how do you change, you know, the way you talk about your company or your products when you're talking to them? Because they always seem to have a different angle or perspective of what they're interested in versus when you're kind of selling yourself or products to a store or a consumer. What were some of those shifts? And for listeners, if someone's raising money or wants to, how do you have to kind of approach that?
I mean, I think for younger companies, investors invest in the founders. You have to still, you know, and that's a similarity that you have when you're selling a product because half the time people are buying into the person that they're talking to. So if you're early stage or pre-revenue, it is all about your experience, your plan for the future, your knowledge of your industry, your awareness, of some of the threats that could come in, how well you understand your competition, your go-to-market strategy. Like, I think at the end of the day, it's demonstrating the poise to potentially handle issues and your existing knowledge. At the same time, you know, a lot of investors are very money oriented, obviously. They want to know they're going to get a return. So you're obviously diving into the granularity of your COGS, your cost of goods, your hiring strategy, your expansion strategy. This is stuff you're never going to talk to about with a buyer potentially. You know, the buyer, you're talking about how easy it is to sell this thing. And these are the differentiators that are going to make it fly off the shelves for your staff and all of the support you can give them. So it's just knowing your business really well and understanding the landscape as best as you can, which also happens to be very difficult in cannabis because there's very little specific data that's aggregated across every company. You know, we have bits and pieces of data, but it's not everybody buys into BDS or headset or things like that. So it's like a strong founder. If you're not a strong like potential operator or existing operator, it doesn't matter how good the numbers are. Sometimes they have to really trust you. So it comes down to who you are anyways.
Probably helped a lot for you not being pre-revenue. You had some traction. You'd been at it for a few years. Does that give you a big leg up when you are talking to investors?
Actually, no.
Really? I found interesting.
That, yeah. So, you know, there were certain companies in the accelerator that were pre-revenue, and I think that they could put speculative valuations on the companies and our experiences, whereas we had historical data. So with our historical data, it is what it is. You can't really hide what you've done in the past. So I think it goes both ways. Like in comparison, we were very ready and relatively speaking, just a good target for an investor because they saw that we had been able to grow year over year. But you know, at the same time, if you haven't made any money, but you have a fantastic idea and an incredible team, the cap doesn't even really exist. It's all in the sky.
Yeah, all speculative. Yeah. That's interesting. And we see that in cannabis now. Big valuations now all going down as it was overinflated. But it makes sense that if you haven't had any sales yet, it's a little easier to say, you know, here's the market size. Here's our target. We can go for this. But actually executing that and achieving that's a different story. That's interesting. Yeah, I would think you've been in a few years. That'd be an advantage. But I could totally see how it might go the other way around.
I think it was totally an advantage in that particular curated group. But it did have its drawbacks.
Yeah. It did, but you know, there'd also be times when someone would challenge you on something and you could say, well, I understand this because I've been doing this for 6 years.
Yeah, that is true.
You know, I have experience of how to do this a certain way that I believe is correct. So it did work to our advantage sometimes, but yeah, some people definitely think they can ask for a ton of money based on.
One more question on the raising money side, and then we'll go over. I want to talk about kind of the hemp market and that transition or moving there as well. Are there, you know, we always kind of hear companies raise this amount of money and it's great. They're moving forward or they're growing. What are the kind of downside or risks that you've seen maybe other companies or that people should be looking for where, you know, you could take the wrong approach or an investor wants a return too quickly and you're forced to, like, you know, in a position where you can't do something like that. Are there certain things you guys look for? Have you seen other companies struggle with when it comes to raising money that a listener, if they're doing this, should really look out for?
Ask us in 2 years. I mean, I don't know. I think the emotional side of taking on investors is really interesting. It's like, it's a real shift. If you've been on your own for 6 years, like we have, and then you have investors, everything changes. It's not like you have a boss, but you definitely have a feeling of obligation. So look out for your own tolerance for that shift, first of all, I would suggest. I think, yeah, you know, especially with VC funding, VCs are very aggressive. They want to see a return. They want to see you raise again. They want to see you exit. I think making sure that you know what you want long term out of a company before you get an investor is crucial. So, you know, if someone wants to maintain a company and have it be a legacy to their children and they want to do this for the next 20 years, that's not a VC funded scenario, because a VC is going to want to see everything. You know, they're going to see a multiple return. So that's more a private equity thing. Or, you know, we can get loans, but maybe a private loan. So I think the biggest thing to look out for is your own expectations and to align them with the types of investors that are having conversations with you. What do you think, Jody?
I agree with that. I mean, we're pretty lucky to have a great set of investors, and, you know, everyone's really friendly and we get along. I think our goals are pretty much aligned, but I have heard horror stories of other companies taking on investors and then kind of losing control of the direction of their company and things going horribly wrong. I'm not scared of that with our group, but it is a possibility.
Yeah.
Something to be aware of. Yeah, I like that advice of really know. I mean, you got to really know your long-term plan and then find the investor that will align with. And early, it's hard too, because you said it's emotional and it makes sense. So you might just, you know, think and raise money and you get an opportunity and it might not be right, but it's the one you got. So you might take it. I mean, it's just hard, period. There's no easy way to do it. But yeah, I like that that advice. So you were talking about the hemp CBD market and Greater Goods is your hemp CBD line. Leaf Goods are your THC products, in Oregon in the regulated market. What have been some of the either learning curve or that process of going into the hemp CBD market? You mentioned it's really a different market. What have some of the things that challenges, obstacles, things you've noticed?
Yeah, I mean, this is basically mainstream CPG, right? Mm. So now we're dealing with grocery stores, those onboarding processes. There are so many acronyms related to traditional retail that it would blow your mind. And for people who have been in it for a while, they rattle off, like we do, cannabinoid science. So it's not beyond the realm of understanding, but it is a learning curve to understand how to function in a normal world at this point, because we've been in a bubble for so long. So that's been a challenge. Understanding how to sell things on a national level and who to bring onto your team to enable you to do that. So different. Because, hey, we're in Oregon. We can literally drive to wherever we need to be and we can't drive any further. So that's been tough. You know, at the same time, we have a leg up because we have such a thick skin around the challenges with banking and credit card processing and things like that, that, you know, if the bank account gets shut down, a normal person coming in would probably freak out. We just move on to the next bank. It's really, you know, and that only happened once, by the way, but you know, it's just like, it's the real world out there. That's an issue. Otherwise, you know, making the things is relatively the same. Getting a kitchen is much easier in terms of licensure. And, you know, it's really just how to advertise and market to this big world and sell out in the big world when, you know, maybe people weren't aware of your brand before and not have that automatic crossover.
Yeah. Have you found on the CBD side specific kind of retailers that have been a good fit for you? You mentioned, like, you know, grocery stores, but I mean, you see everywhere selling CBD products now and all kinds of different stores. Have you found kind of a niche channel or anything that looks really promising that you think might be a better fit, or, you know, big, I mean, you could go Whole Foods and 1,000 stores or something crazy like that too. It's so many different ways you can take it compared to the THC market, like you said.
Yeah. So with us, Whole Foods is not ready for edibles yet. And I think that they are still very guarded, but that's obviously the holy grail is the Whole Foods world, because that's our customer, our conscientious consumers, the Whole Foods consumer. I think for us, you know, in all CBD, it's really like in the edible realm, it's a natural foods angle. So places like New Seasons and the Erewhons of the world and sort of those smaller chains that might have a deeper understanding of the benefits of hemp CBD without the huge corporate structure that they might be afraid of introducing things to. So natural foods, some wellness. We have a pretty awesome petite chain of stores in Chicago and Dallas. That do really well. It's a highly curated environment that does home delivery. They're called Foxtrot. I have to give a shout out to them because they're amazing. Texas loves CBD. So anybody in Texas is super into it. So for us, it's like, it's a mixture of the natural foods kind of health world, you know, smaller health oriented stores and CBD stores. There's a lot of these little, very specifically CBD focused boutiques that are bringing us on. So it's really, it's been an interesting mixture of
and
stuff.
And those seem like the obvious ones that were perfect fit, but we're also in some like skater punk rock record store.
Yeah, we're in a record store.
Nice.
And we just did the Northwest Chocolate Fest over the weekend, and a woman from who owned an adult store asked about wholesale. Yeah. So there's a lot of smaller independent venues, I think, that are interested. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So on that, like you, and again, you said this earlier, in Oregon market, you can kind of drive around, see people. In that situation, nobody's driving to Texas. What's your sales process like to get kind of outside the state? Is a lot of cold calling and cold emailing, or what's, how do you get into some of those stores?
I mean, at this point, it's been a lot of inbound inquiries. Nice. people coming to us. I think it's word of mouth, social media. We are going to be doing a search for a salesperson, and we'll start with the West Coast, so it's not crazy overwhelming. But yeah, I think at a certain point, you look at who's on their shelves, you reach out like anyone else. Some larger chains will have vendor application forms that you can engage in. I think, you know, we are also part of some packaged food groups and people that, you know, we can track the types of products and where they're being carried so that we're not barking up the wrong tree. So yeah, it's like anything else, cold calling, sending samples. You know, we have a whole campaign of, you know, sending things to influencers so that we have a little more social media presence. So maybe these people will see us anyways. But to be honest, you know, we're not an overnight success. I'm not going to make it sound like that, but we do get inquiries multiple times a week from different people in different locations. Like I said, a lot of Texans.
Yeah.
But a lot of people just write and say, hey, I'm really interested because they saw a piece, you know, in a larger publication, or they heard a podcast and they were interested. So I think, you know, there's so many ways to get out in front of potential customers. You know, there's also the distributor aspect. You know, CBD is a lot of bigger distributors will not carry hemp CBD, but some smaller regional distributors will, and that, you know, we're looking into those options too.
Yeah, there's just so many angles. That's what's so cool about the hemp CBD side is, I mean, there's just so many different ways you could go about it and get really creative with your strategy. That's exciting. What, so that's kind of on the, you know, B2B side, you're selling to retailers, wholesale. What about e-commerce and direct to consumer? Are you taking a heavy focus on that side as well and trying to build up that channel?
That's a good question. I mean, I think we've been spending actually this week really heavily trying to decide where the weight is going to be. And I'm not sure we've come to the conclusion. The initial strategy, and I think the overall strategy, is really to go B2B, particularly because we're chocolate, and chocolate's very difficult to ship in warm weather. You end up incurring these pretty big shipping charges that either get passed off to the consumer and they're not jazzed about it, or we're absorbing it. But you know, we're looking into some broader marketing campaigns to increase e-commerce, especially now in the winter and with holiday coming. But I think, you know, the weight will go on wholesale. And then we also have a small retail space attached to our manufacturing space. So we have the luxury of being able to welcome people into our environment and educate them around our products and sell them directly to them, which is, I think, a pretty unique ability for many companies. Very lucky that Retail Frontage came with our new kitchen. So, that's a whole other ball of wax. Starting up a retail presence is yet another learning curve that kind of fell into our laps. Yeah, it's sort of a melange of things, but I think wholesale for us is really the core of what we're aiming for.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a hard one with, you know, which direction to head. And again, those are really two separate models that you have to set up and build and infrastructure. The direct to consumer is so kind of attractive because you get retail pricing, which is significant over wholesale pricing, but it's individual orders. You have to have a fulfillment center. I've been thinking, if, you know, you take both models, you are doing direct to consumer and selling wholesale. Have any of the retailers, said anything about like a conflict of interest, or they wouldn't want to carry you because you are selling e-com and you could sell for a lower price? So maybe you use a wholesale store for someone to discover you, they go to your website and they're like, oh, I can always get it for less directly from their website. Like, has any retailers kind of talked to you about that, or has that been an issue at all?
No, and I'm actually surprised that nobody has, because we have worked in companies where there was an online presence, and there were frequently conversations with channel partners about MSRP. I think it's just a natural thing. And because it's this like crazy world, people aren't even bringing it up. And a lot of our partners are very small businesses. So they probably doesn't occur to them that much. But, you know, a lot of our partners are brick and mortar. So they, you know, they're going to have a local community of people that are going to come in and they're going to reap the benefits of that higher price point. Obviously they're buying wholesale from us, but you know, there's so many, perks to having interesting products in store, especially if it's not a CBD store. It's just such a fascinating conversation and you're kind of like the cool kid on the block a lot of times because you're not like everybody else. So no one has brought it up. You know, people can price things how they want. We can do an MSRP. You know, some stores don't do Keystone markup and that's their strategy. There's other stores do, and they require certain promotional, discounts to play with them. So I think everybody has, especially the bigger grocery chains, you know, they all have their ways that they know how to make their bottom line. But yeah, no one's brought it up. And it's funny you ask that because like, I've thought about it multiple times. Like, when is somebody going to mention something?
Yeah.
But it hasn't. It hasn't come up at all.
Yeah, it's probably the bigger, like Whole Foods would definitely probably have something in a contract. Like, you, and maybe the smaller stores aren't really looking at that as much.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you said, you know, wholesale to brick and mortar. I see. Have you looked at wholesale to online resellers, you know, Amazon being the big obvious one? I see CBD products on there kind of come and go. Is that a channel that you've been also considering or looking at besides Amazon, even other just digital retailers, resellers?
Yeah, I mean, we just started working with White Label CBD. They're out of New York and they are a e-commerce CBD platform. So, and that's exciting. So absolutely, there's a number of people that just focus on CBD online. And I think Amazon right now is not going to be carrying full spectrum products that I'm aware of, or there would be vast changes to the packaging.
Yeah.
So I think we're quite at the Amazon level. You know, we're trying to grow a little organically to start with, but you know, Amazon is Whole Foods. So
yeah, it's such an interesting dynamic.
We will not compromise certain aspects of our products to something like Amazon. Like, we are staunchly committed to full spectrum CBD. We'll never use isolate unless for some reason it's the only thing you can do in the United States if rules change. But it's not worth us adjusting our game just to get on Amazon. So to be determined.
Yeah. That's going to keep evolving. On the kind of production side, and I think a lot of what I'm always fascinated by, and I just don't ever hear it really discussed, you know, kind of the internal operations of a company and scaling up is just a really difficult thing to do. And I think it's a really big thing where a lot of companies end up failing and it's not discussed a lot. You know, branding, marketing, sales, those are kind of exciting topics. Internally, as you've scaled over time, what have been some of the challenges or, you know, unpredicted things that were difficult for you to overcome?
Well, there's definitely like man hours for production. I'll speak to production. I mean, there's there's a lot of man hours that you have to be prepared to put into it. And that's really tricky to find the right kind of hiring for that. We, as of right now, I do most of the production, but kind of expected that. So what we were able to do when we did raise some money is to buy equipment that was beyond, the volume of what we needed. So I bought a really giant, like, enrobing machine. And so even if I work by myself, I can crank out a ton of chocolate and rogue marshmallows, which is one of our biggest sellers. So we looked at it as a machinery would help us scale, you know, and like my normal temporary machine, I can crank out a ton of bars in a day. So that was one aspect we looked at. So we overbought equipment so we would be able to scale up when it was necessary. Which was kind of a mistake we made in cannabis. Like we bought a very small, very affordable enrobing machine, to get us started with our biggest selling product now. Of course, I wish I would have spent twice as much money and bought a larger machine. So, you know, production would have been quadruple as what it is today, but we didn't. So we didn't make that mistake. We bought new equipment for this.
Yeah. I think the infrastructure that revolves around people is the hardest, right? Like, scaling involves all these esoteric jobs, like account managers and fulfillment managers and general managers and salespeople and biz dev people. And, it's fascinating when you grow that you realize there's these nuanced positions that need to be filled in the world, and you can't do everything yourself. I think that's the painful lesson here is we're pretty good at a lot of things, but we can't do it all. So yeah, I think Jody's right. We made some good decisions on the amount of space we rented and the objects that we bought, but the people is really the key. And so that's, you know, thinking ahead and getting together a hiring strategy, I think, is really important. We're going through that right now and looking at, you know, the steps along the way. When this, if this, then that, right? So if you grow to this point, what are you going to need to do? And don't do it at the last minute.
Yeah. That's just so tricky. People and managing that, and business doesn't scale linear fashion. So to, you know, $1 million in sales isn't $2 million just doing double as much. Like, yeah, the dynamics change with different new positions. And as you scale a little further, a position could need to go away as well. And kind of, I mean, I'm sure a lot of the advisors through the initiative, that's a huge asset to be able to bounce ideas off people and get feedback. Someone that's been there before, kind of help you predict that road ahead. What's so kind of mid to long term plan, 3 to 5 years out? Are you looking at THC products in other states, or are you thinking keeping that in Oregon and really focusing on just the hemp CBD and expanding that out further? What's on that kind of 3 to 5 year horizon for you?
We're starting to have conversations with a number of states, more emerging states than established markets, actually right now. So we're going to try and get into at least 2 or 3 states in 2020. To expand. Oregon, you know, like we said, was super challenging. It's not the place where we're going to see massive profits. We'll always maintain Oregon on the THC side, but we want to be in other states significantly next year, hopefully the first half of next year. So we're going to be running these two avenues at the same time. And, you know, trying to find ways to streamline those processes as we go. You know, 3 to 5 years at this point, our primary goal is to show a ton of value around the brands. We're those people who don't necessarily want to be working at this in 20 years. We're not in our 20s anymore. So we have to start planning for, you know, the next step in life. So, you know, the goals for a company that are looking for some kind of merger or acquisition are very different from, you know, the companies that, you know, are being started by younger people who want to be doing it for a very long time. So, you know, the strategies of where we want to be in 3 to 5 years are a little bit different, and it's all about expansion at this point and like a huge amount of brand awareness. That's our real goal. And it's even a 2 to 3 year goal to get to that point. We want to accelerate it pretty quickly, and just charge ahead as fast as we can.
Yeah. Is there a specific strategy for going into other states? Cause it seems there's a few different ways to do it. Have you kind of settled on a strategy or what that might look like?
Yeah, I mean, the multiple different strategies. One is go incorporate in that state, find a space of your own, obtain a license, hire a team, and start from scratch. Mm-hmm. We are not going to do that. Mm-hmm. The other strategy, of course, is finding partners who are essentially co-packers. We're going to have to source our oil in-state anyways, so you have to find those partners to begin with. So we're really looking for strategic relationships in these states that where we can grow with them. I think centralizing your management and your HR and doing licensing agreements with other companies is really super smart because there's just less bandwidth that's required. You also get some benefits of working that way because 280E doesn't necessarily come into play because you're licensing IP out to other states. You're not starting these manufacturing facilities from the ground up. So there's some positive tax implications to that, even though sometimes it costs a little bit more in those licensing fees. You're still getting some niceties around, you know, a lack of the annoyances that you would find otherwise.
Yeah. I thought one thing that's with the hemp CBD line, I think you could get brand penetration into a new state before your THC products arrive. Have you found any dispensaries in, you know, THC legalized states that have wanted to carry just your CBD products, or is that a strategy you've tried yet?
Not really. I think I don't really understand the rules in other states in comparison to Oregon, where you cannot carry regulated hemp. But there's a dispensary in Georgia that carries us, and they're called a dispensary, but I'm not 100% sure how that works in the state. You know, we require every new account to provide us with their EIN and reseller numbers, and we make sure they're legit, but you know, I'm not sure how it works in other states. So I'm definitely kind of staying away from the cannabis world per se, and really going for mainstream primarily, because I think that's more of our target. You know, some smoke shops have written to us, some places that kind of have one foot on that side of the world. Right. We obviously welcome them into our, you know, world of partnerships, but we really focus on the more mainstream providers.
Yeah, makes sense. If they come in, you work with them. But if you're actually going out and trying to do a marketing campaign or approach, you really got to be focused with those, because you have so many opportunities where you could spread yourself. Picking that right channel that lines with your brand makes a lot of sense. As we kind of get near the end, the last topic I wanted to hit on around hemp CBD still, how are you planning? You know, you talked about maybe the regulations changing, or, you know, kind of a really bad scenario. They only allow isolate, which I can't see that really happening, but, you know, who knows what the FDA or someone's going to decide to do. I mean, they can make some crazy decisions that don't make any sense. Are you doing anything specific as strategy or planning to try to be more resilient or adaptable if something like that happens? Or how are you thinking about that? Just ever-changing regulations, the FDA, how are you kind of looking at that?
Yeah, I mean, you can't lose sleep over it. I think I have these conversations with our advisors, and every once in a while I go, let me take your temperature. How anxious are you? And if they say, don't lose sleep, okay.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the things we do is we have two really amazing providers for oil, and so we're not incredibly diverse in where we source our oil from, but we are diverse enough that there is some agility there should things happen, like to adapt potentially to any rule changes. I think because we do a lot of the making ourselves, you're able to make swift changes as needed as well. Because we don't outsource things. It's not this lumbering beast to, you know, add something to your packaging, just like we have to do in cannabis. We've been really adaptable in cannabis when rules change every year. So I think we're just, you know, we're anticipating we have the confidence in ourselves to just know we can handle it. You know, I think the hardest part would be succumbing to something like only isolate being permitted, because we ourselves don't really enjoy using that type of product. So, you know, I think if that was the big change, I think it would be a huge disappointment to the medical side of full plant.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, who knows? I don't know. Maybe we would decide we don't want to do that. We'll just sit for it. We'll find, you know, find the best possible least bad thing on earth. So, you know, I think it's just the fact that we're so DIY to begin. We've adjusted to so many changes in the past.
Yeah, you've got practice at
yeah.
it. Awesome. Well, I appreciate the time. The last two things I like to ask every guest, especially a business operator like yourself. Number one, are you hiring? If any listeners might be a good fit for a certain position. And then number two, where can people find you?
So yes, we are hiring. We have not created the job posting yet, but we are looking for a really dedicated part to full-time salesperson for the West Coast who has experience with CPG products and has a passion for CBD, of course. So we're actively looking for that type of person. And are we looking for anybody else?
I mean, we are going to need another chocolatier at some point. How soon that is, I'm not sure.
But come see us if you're into chocolate, because we like to nerd out about chocolate anyways. And everyone can find us online at www.hellograder.com and in Southeast Portland at 1323 Southeast 7th Avenue, just north of Hawthorne.
Awesome. Does the salesperson need to be local in Portland, or could that potentially be a remote position?
That's a great question. I think the right person find their way.
Right. Yep. I think that's the right answer. Yeah. The right person is so key for that kind of role, because you're out there anyways, most of the time anyways, not in an office. So awesome. Well, thank you both for the time. I really appreciate it. It's really cool to just hear your story and experience so far being in the THC market, going into the hemp CBD side. Really appreciate the time and sharing some insights with our listeners. So thank you for coming on.
Well, thanks for having us, Wayne.
Thank you.
All right, that was the episode with Carrie and Jody. Thank you for listening. If you're around the Portland area or on the West Coast, reach out about the sales position they're looking to hire for. Sounds like a great opportunity. And also, if you're around Portland, they're looking to hire soon around the production of chocolate on their line there. So reach out to them if that might be a good fit for you. And that's it for this episode. So thank you for listening. If you have enjoyed this episode, past episodes, please share this with a friend, a family member, a colleague, whoever it might be. Share this with someone that you think would enjoy learning about the cannabis, business of cannabis, or the science of cannabis. And that's it for this one. So we'll be back next Monday afternoon with another episode and a new guest. Until then, thank you for listening.
The ideas presented in this podcast are meant for general informational purposes only and should not be considered professional advice. The Periodic Effects podcast, Periodic Edibles, and all affiliated subsidiaries disclaim any liability for any damages arising out of reliance on the information presented. Please consult licensed professionals for any medical, legal, or business advice.
This podcast was brought to you by the Cannabis Media Collective. The media contributors within the Cannabis Media Collective do our very best to remain as accurate as possible, but take no responsibility for any inaccurate details or facts. If a story interests you, we're glad to have brought it to your attention, but please take the time to research the details for yourself.